May it please the court. My name is Hollis Whitson. My bar number is 32911. With me at council table is Eric Samler, who's been on the briefs and also represents Justin Connor. Today in the courtroom, we have Justin Connor's family. We also have the family of the victim in this case, the Tate family. And we continue to have deep respect for the loss that they've suffered. According to the jury, though, Justin Connor did not kill Mr. Tate. According to the jury and all of the scientific evidence, Justin Connor was not even in the room. Gerald McPherson's hair and blood and palm prints and all kinds of other physical evidence was there. The salient issue in this case, under the jury's verdicts, was where was Justin Connor? Was he outside in the car while McPherson went in and did this horrible deed? Was he, as Justin said, not there? And on that salient point, what this case boiled down to, there's darn little evidence. There's the circumstantial evidence that Justin was seen by the police with McPherson a few hours before and a few hours after the crime. And there's the testimony of Chad Barr. And on those two slender reeds stands this case. And my client, who, since he was a teenager, is behind bars the rest of his life, and the murderer, who indisputably was the person that alone killed Mr. Tate, was given the sweet plea deal and will soon have a parole eligibility date. So the question in this case boils down to whether or not this trial was fundamentally fair, whether or not there's prejudice. And his location during the crime, which was what Chad Barr was there to talk about, is the central issue in the case. And it boiled down to Chad Barr. Is there a reasonable probability of a different outcome without that alibi notice? Absolutely. The prosecution would probably never have contacted Chad Barr in the first place.
Hadn't he already been listed as a witness?
Well, he and a lot of other people had been listed as witnesses, but the prosecution had not developed him as a witness, had not talked to him.
How do we know that?
It's in the record that at the 35C hearing and also at trial, that the prosecution didn't have just very tiny little bit of contact, and that's all in the record. They had very little contact with him. There was this preliminary hearing. He didn't end up testifying. They had this theory that somehow Justin waived the preliminary hearing to avoid Chad Barr from testifying. Of course, Chad had nothing to say at that time. There was nothing Barr had to say at the preliminary hearing. For whatever reason, he didn't testify. And then there is nothing in the record that indicates any contact until he called the police upon the notice of alibi being filed.
Ms. Whitson, does the record indicate why the prosecution listed Chad Barr as a witness?
Well, no, they listed Justin's mother as a witness. They listed his dad. So they list everybody. I mean, it's just I hate to say that, but it is the pro forma. Back then it was only 20 or 50 witnesses. These days it's hundreds get noticed. Everybody that's everybody. But they routinely do not interview people like Mr. Barr, who were family-like. He's living at the home. He's a family friend. Or, you know, they wouldn't have interviewed him any more than they would have probably tried to interview Justin's mom. And in fact, I believe it's in the record that his trial testimony was that the attorneys had instructed him to not talk to the police. So there was some initial contact, but there was nothing useful. I mean, there was nothing there. Even if they had known about him, they may or may not have called him as a witness. But that's not the point. The point is he wouldn't have testified about this cockamamie fabrication of this alibi. There wouldn't have been an alibi notice filed. All of that is the result, the undeniable result, of deficient performance and probably also of a conflict of interest. But absolutely deficient performance. There's not going to end up being any question about that.
Deficient performance by who?
By the attorney who noticed him as an alibi witness and had never talked to him. by the attorney who based any decision, even if we want to call it strategy, based it on a patently unreasonable investigation, which gives it zero presumption of validity.
Isn't that a factual finding that the court made adverse to your client?
No, the court did not make any finding as to whether or not the attorney had talked to Chad Barr before.
The attorney's decision was within the range of reasonable professional standards.
Oh, that's a legal finding. These questions are reviewed de novo, both the deficient performance and prejudice. And of course, that's what the judge found. She thought it was perfectly reasonable. Okay. Begs the question: an attorney who never talks to a witness and then raises, really, I think the testimony was it was a stupid defense, or maybe that's what Ms. Galley called it in her pleadings. You know, a technical alibi defense is rare. Usually, you call some witnesses, they come, they go, oh, maybe he was with me, maybe not. But to file a technical affirmative defense of alibi, where you are nailed down to the date and time, the prosecution can change the date and time of the crime. This is a highly technical, actually very rarely used defense.
How could the prosecution possibly change the date and time of the crime in this case?
Well, in this case, actually, there was some variation. Bad example, but it was an example I was giving, that it's a very highly technical defense that binds all kinds of actors. It certainly binds the defense. And it's much better to, as Mr. Garash said, he had no choice. I think Mr. Garash, when he testified, actual trial counsel, testified that there was a distinction between a general denial, where you call the witnesses and you say, look, I wasn't there, and Justin testified he wasn't there. He was at the Gambler. Bless you. And an alibi defense, which just ups the ante, if you will. And I think the testimony was very good at the post-conviction hearing. But whether it was a technically alibi defense or whether it was technically general denial, the point is, Chad Barr, none of this would have happened had that attorney interviewed this person that was alleged by somebody to have been an alibi witness. Let me explain. The salient testimony here is this testimony about what I call the List meeting. The meeting where, and those of you that have read the record, and I suspect many of you have, I know at least one of you has read every word of it. This was the meeting where Chad Barr and Justin discussed the false alibi, knowing it was false. Knowing it was false to the extent that Justin said, I was at the Gambler, I might have been with Chad. Chad said, I don't think you were, but let's go over this false alibi. That meeting never would have happened if the attorney had done the modicum. Now, I know this was the attorney's very first homicide trial ever. I get that. But even those of us that all of us had our very first homicide trial, and you would never, ever, ever put yourself in that situation. Here's Chad Barr, who's basically living with the family, at least at the time of this horrible crime. Somebody, whether it was mom or whether it was Gilbert Valdez, the investigator, comes and says, we have an alibi witness. And the attorney still doesn't talk to him? The attorney lets this situation spin out of control, and suddenly there's this List meeting, and suddenly people are talking, and the attorney still doesn't talk to him 20 sentences before trial? Now, this is objectively deficient performance. The question, that's not even the question in the case. The attorney candidly said, it's the dumbest thing I ever did. You would never do this. And a defense attorney would never put on a witness list any witness they hadn't interviewed. The prosecution can do that. The defense attorney cannot, because it opens you up to all kinds of things. Certainly not an attorney's who sees this guy on the state's witness list. You know he's on the state's witness list. You've never talked to him about the crime, and suddenly you notice him up on this highly technical alibi defense. So the List meeting would not have happened. Well, by the time mom or Gilbert Valdez or whoever came and said, oh, maybe this guy suddenly months into the situation, now it's going to be an alibi witness, the attorney would have said, let me talk to the guy. Now, and the other reason that the finding, it's not a finding, it's a legal opinion, the chief reason that the judge's legal opinion was incorrect is that it wasn't based on a reasonable investigation. She didn't address the reasonability of the investigation. Her word. I've read that opinion many times in the last 72 hours. She doesn't even address the investigation.
What is the relevance, if any, to this sub-issue about reasonable performance regarding an upcoming deadline on, I guess, having to disclose defenses? I'm not exactly sure what it was.
That has gotten so far off base. The issue that was raised on the direct appeal and the issue that initially came up was whether or not they should have let the attorney file the notice of alibi later than he did, which is a red herring. The attorney never should have noticed this witness as an alibi witness. He's a liar. Now, according to the court's order, he's a known perjurer, but there was an issue on direct appeal. Did they make him file it too early? There was language in my initial appeal briefs in the last go-round that said, gee, this premature alibi, he shouldn't have filed it. Really, the point is he shouldn't have filed it at all, ever. And now we have a guy, Barr, who the district court has found to be a perjurer. And now we have the question whether or not this guy gets a new trial. And he absolutely gets a new trial. Absolutely. The Lafler case can't be more clear. For 30 years, the U.S. Supreme Court has said you have to remove the taint from the ineffective assistance. The only way to remove the taint from the ineffective assistance here, because you're going to find deficient performance, trust me, you will find this. It's impossibly not to. And then you're going to find prejudice. There's clearly prejudice in this case. There's overwhelming. And I started there at the beginning of my argument because we had to detail it. So the question is, what is this court going to do? And the state always says the real question in the case, and it is, what can you do? Is it going to be the same thing? He got the new trial and the new lawyer. Are we just going to have another trial with a new trial and a new lawyer? Right? And that's the question we've always had. What does the new trial look like? And Lafler versus Cooper tells us, you remove the taint from the ineffectiveness. So at the new trial, there's not you're gonna tell the court, go hold a new trial. No notice of alibi. The DAs cannot talk about the fact that notice was ever filed.
Can't they still call Mr. Barr as a witness?
Well, I think you should say, first of all, I'm not sure they will. He's been declared to be a perjurer. They presented his testimony, taking the position at trial that he was telling the truth about the investigator making up this alibi.
Well, the 35C court found otherwise.
Now the 35C court says, nope, you were wrong, he's a liar. I'm not sure the DA is going to call Mr. Barr at the next trial.
Why wouldn't it be reasonable that they would call him for testimony that the defendant directly contrived this alibi?
No, they're not. I'm not really sure they would call a perjurer to the stand, period. He would get eaten alive on cross. And I think the court might decide to have a stipulation that he's been found to be perjured, perhaps on other topics, but quite close topics. And again, I don't presume the court, the DAs will put a perjurer on the stand. But if they do, his testimony would be limited, and he would testify. I think the more interesting question is Justin's testimony. I think that would probably come in. And frankly, it wasn't that bad, the Chad Barr. I think some of this will come in. But I think you should strike Chad Barr entirely. I think you should say this is a fruit of the ineffective assistance of counsel. It's a remedy. He's an unreliable witness, and he's a perjurer.
Can you cite us to any authority that does a sort of a fruit of the poisonous tree analysis applicable to ineffective assistance?
Yeah, I'm getting a little sloppy with my metaphors here. No, but Lafler v. Cooper says you have to cure it. And there's a lot of cases in there that go back 30 years that say you have to fashion a remedy. But this is really what I think you should do. If you're not inclined to say, go back, do a new trial, no alibi notice, unless they somehow refile one, no Chad Barr. No mention of this, what came from this ineffective assistance. If you're not willing to do that, I think you do exactly what the court in Lafler did. You send it back downstairs, tell them to do a new trial, and you let the trial court see if the state's even going to call Chad Barr. Maybe they're ready to give Mr. Connor the same deal they gave the killer. We don't know what's going to happen, and we can't speculate. But we do know he got ineffective assistance. We do know the trial was fundamentally unfair as a result of it. And we do know that it cries out for a remedy. And if you want to let the trial court decide what comes in and what doesn't, I think you should do that. I'd like to reserve my 21 seconds.
Thank you, Ms. Whitson.
Thank you.
Counsel, at some point in your argument, even though it was only briefly alluded to, I'd like you to talk about whether you think there was an actual conflict here. If not, why not? And if there was an actual conflict, the consequences. But you don't have to start there.
Okay, thank you. May it please the court, John First for the people. This case was remanded so that the trial court could determine two narrow questions. One, whether original counsel was ineffective by fabricating Barr's corroboration for the alibi. By fabricating. Second question was whether original counsel was operating under a conflict of interest given his fabrication of the alibi evidence. That's it. The trial court determined with the record support that original counsel didn't fabricate the alibi. He said he didn't. It was Barr's corroboration originated with Barr himself. Now those determinations and this inquiry on remand and this appeal, and it's dispositive of this case. Now on remand, once this went back, and within about almost 6 months after the trial court got it back, defense files and amended the supplemental 35C, raising no fewer than five claims, new claims. And two of those change the issues for which the case was originally remanded.
Did the people object to that?
They didn't. They certainly didn't stipulate. And you can't waive it because in the brief I cited Musgrave, which goes back to Galbraith, 1910 Colorado case. And it talks about the court's authority and power. You know, and I'll quote Galbraith here. The court to which a mandate, when a case is remanded with specific directions, the court to which such mandate is directed has no power to do anything but to obey the mandate. The mandate.
One of my question was, did the people object below to the amended 35C?
No, Your Honor.
In fact, didn't they represent to the trial court that, didn't the prosecutor represent to the trial court that he or she had been in communication with the Attorney General's
Absolutely.
Office and encourage the trial court to decide this case on the broadest possible basis?
No, that's not true. On the broadest possible basis, absolutely.
No, didn't, to decide all of the issues presented by the defendant?
It was our advice that the trial court deal with both deficient performance and prejudice.
Issues.
Well, it was on these, abundance of caution to deal with the issues that were raised in the motion. The supplemental motion.
Okay, so the trial court was encouraged through the prosecutor and perhaps through your office to deal with all of the issues presented in the supplemental motion.
But that doesn't mean the court had the power to do so.
Isn't it?
I mean, it can't be waived.
Isn't it invited error?
Invited error doesn't apply here because invited error is, we can defend on any grounds. And it's not, invited error goes to a defendant, an appellant introducing error into the proceedings. And invited error isn't an issue here.
Mr. First,
it's not a principle that applies.
Judge Casebolt, in addition to what you said, specifically said that the remanded the case and allowed the defendant to amend his 35C motion to add a claim for a conflict of interest.
Given his fabrication of the evidence, and that was limited to, given his fabrication of the evidence, that's all that was at issue, Your Honor.
I don't understand the basis for your saying that because that's not what Judge Casebolt's opinion says. It says given his fabrication of the Barr alibi.
Correct. That's limited the conflict of interest issue to the concept of whether original counsel fabricated the alibi, and that's it.
Wouldn't Mr. Concilia have an actual conflict once he was accused of having fabricated evidence?
No.
That wouldn't be an actual conflict?
I apologize. I'm not asking you to concede that it would be, but isn't it somewhat artificial to say that the actual conflict inquiry is limited to whether Concilia did contrive the alibi when we have authority indicating that even if he was merely accused by the district attorney of having fabricated an alibi, that could be an actual conflict?
At most, it was a potential conflict. And Rule 3.7 was about a year old at that point, and it changed the discipline, the code. And the rule said that a lawyer shall, and it's not really a conflict so much as, because it didn't have a personal interest, a property interest in the case, didn't. It was wasn't representing concurrent witnesses, clients, or successive clients. So it was under 3.0, which is 1.7, 1.8, 1.9 in the rules. We're dealing with 3.7 here, where a lawyer shall not act as advocate at a trial. And that's what Concilia testified to. He said he was going to make the prosecution mistrial the case if they produced the bar evidence, and then he would have to be a witness. And
that's the witness disqualification rule.
That's correct.
With the attorney disqualification, attorney witness disqualification.
And that's my point. That's the rule that's at issue here. It's not so much the conflict as whether or not he would have been disqualified because he would have had to testify. That's the, you know, if there's a conflict, that's the conflict.
Okay, and so it's your position that there was no conflict, even though Mr. Barr accused Mr. Concilia in statements to the district attorney of effectively having suborned perjury. That's not a conflict?
Well, what I said, Your Honor, is most it's a potential conflict, not an actual conflict.
When does an accusation against a lawyer of having suborned perjury transition from a potential to an actual conflict? What's the operative fact that makes that distinction?
Well, you know, according to Rule 3.7, a lawyer shall not act as an advocate at a trial in which the lawyer is likely to be a necessary witness. And he would have been a necessary witness.
Well, what about Rule 1.7, which talks about whether the probity of the lawyer's conduct comes to be an issue in the case?
That's just, that's a potential conflict.
But once he's accused to the district attorney, that's still just a potential conflict.
Regardless, Your Honor, even if I agree with you that it's an actual conflict, it doesn't matter.
Why not? Please.
Because the remedy is to disqualify the lawyer and get a new lawyer at that point. And that's what happened.
But what about calling into question, assuming it's an actual conflict, and I respect that you're reserving your position on that, at least one point of view would be that actual conflict hung over Mr. Concilia, I think in his words, like a black cloud for about 6 months between when he learned that Barr had gone to the district attorney and he eventually withdrew. So what about the probity of his strategic decisions during those 6 months?
It had no effect on the trial. He had new counsel.
So you're saying that's the end point?
It has to be.
A new trial and a new lawyer cures all.
For the conflict, yes. Otherwise, he could never get a fair trial. I mean, this whole thing about, we need a new trial without Barr. I mean, really, that's patently ridiculous. I mean, it goes to the fruit of the poisonous, applying the fruit of the poisonous tree to something like this. I mean, that's... never heard of such a thing. And Lafler doesn't support that. Lafler is a case about ineffective assistance of plea counsel for failing to pass along the plea to the defendant. Of course, I mean, it's an entirely different situation there. Of course, the remedy would be different, when you then go to trial. I mean, this conflict of interest, the issue comes up, and a defendant is granted a new trial, where trial counsel was laboring under a conflict. Trial counsel here was not laboring under a conflict. It was original counsel that had, potential conflict.
Well, Mr. First, my understanding, though, of the defendant's argument is that this situation is not like other situations where actual conflict has been argued, because their assertion is that even though Mr. Concilia withdrew as counsel for Mr. Connor, that nevertheless the whole issue of the false alibi remained in the case, and that it never would have been there in the first place if there hadn't been this alleged deficient performance, but also if there hadn't been a possible conflict of interest.
Well, what's deficient performance? Are you talking about the filing the notice of the alibi?
Yes.
Which is not proper before this court. But beyond that, I mean, this is entirely speculation. As you were asking before, Judge, the prosecution had listed him as a witness early on, within weeks after the once Mr. Connor was charged.
But I assume that the prosecution was not contemplating calling Mr. Barr as a witness to testify about a false alibi when the prosecution listed him as a witness.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Of course, at that point. That's hindsight, though, Your Honor. I mean, this whole claim is based on hindsight that, well, if he hadn't, you know, only by filing the alibi notice did this come to light. The point is, even if we're talking about the filing of the notice of alibi, and to finish answering your question, Judge, at the preliminary hearing, just before Barr testified, the defense threw up its hands and conceded probable cause. I've never seen that in a first-degree murder case where the defense concedes probable cause. As I said in my brief, that, you know, they knew about him. That certainly raised the hackles, put the red flags up, put Mr. Barr on their radar. They certainly would have contacted him.
Is there anything in the record that tells us whether or not the prosecution had actually spoken with Mr. Barr before he came forward with the phony alibi story?
I don't believe there's anything in the record that shows that.
One way or the other?
No, I don't believe so.
Thank you.
What findings, if any, did the trial, did the district court make on this actual conflict issue when it went back on remand?
Well, with the actual conflict, that goes to what it was remanded for, and there was no fabrication because it was remanded for the trial court to make findings on the fabrication.
So the trial court made a finding that there was no fabrication, but then I take it didn't go on and discuss in any detail the question of an actual conflict.
No, there was no discussion about an actual conflict in the order. You know, and again, with regard to the conflict, it wasn't trial counsel that labored under this conflict. That's the determinative factor here.
Well, when you say trial counsel, you mean the person who eventually, ultimately...
Not original counsel, yes, Dan Garash. You know, and the point here is that what counsel did was reasonable. He had a deadline. He objected. Trial court overruled that objection. He testified he was panicked to get that in because the court was adamant. He believed that it wouldn't do any good to file a continuance. Instead, he filed a Rule 21. Was it reasonable? Sure. There's more than one way to be reasonable. I mean, he agonized over the decision. His investigator had talked to Barr. So this isn't a situation where they didn't know what Barr was going to testify to. They knew the alibi. The family had been was in favor of it. The family believed in Barr. He couldn't find him. He had an investigator out there full-time looking for him. And because he was investigating full-time, there's no reason to believe that they would have found him after the notice. I mean, that's just... And this court has said already that it would be admissible. The Barr testimony was admissible. If I may finish my comment, please. And if it goes back on retrial, Barr will testify again. Thank you.
First.
The testimony that, or the ruling that Chad Barr could testify is one sentence. It's one sentence in this court's 2002 ruling. The trial court determined the evidence of the false alibi was relevant. That entire relevancy 403 analysis will be dramatically different now that it has been established and declared by the court that the guy's a perjurer. And that's exactly what could have been done after the conflict was discovered. He had months to prove that this perjury was happening, and he laid low, hoping it would sort of go away at trial or something. That's the adverse performance from what the actual conflict that we see.
Thank you, Ms. Witz.
Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. Case will stand submitted. Divisional issue and opinion in due course.